Great. So I want to sort of step back and give kind of a very general talk on what we know about properties of dark energy, what we know more in general about cosmology. When I put together this talk, my target was a graduate student doing quantum computing. So for those of you who are experts, let me apologize for giving a overview and simplifying some of these things. But I think it's useful, given how little we know, to actually step back and think about what our basic assumptions are and what are some of the observational tests that underlie those assumptions. Fundamentally, my kind of view of where we are in cosmology is the universe seems to be both very simple and very strange. I mean, to me, the very surprising thing with the WMAP data and the data from other CMB experiments and galaxy surveys is that all this data, several, 100,000 independent points on the sky, millions of galaxies, all their statistical properties seems to be characterized by five basic numbers. The age of the universe, the density of baryons, the density of matter, the amplitude of fluctuations, and their scale dependence. And in a way, the cosmological constant problem is, in terms of these numbers, the fact that the age of the universe and the matter density don't match up the way they they should if omega matter was one. And it's a universe that, while it's simple, it's quite strange, right? Atoms make up 4% of the universe. We evoke dark matter to make up the next 23%, and the remainder is in the form of seemingly something like vacuum energy. In the context of this picture, when we connect it with inflation, the universe appears to have undergone two periods of cosmic acceleration at two different scales. We're more comfortable with the one at inflation because we feel we don't know much about physics there, so we feel more comfortable inventing new physics back then. But today we thought we knew what was going on, right? There's not new physics lying at 10 to the minus 3 eV. So it's a strange universe. So I thought it's just useful, and some of this is just a pedagogical review for people outside the field, to go back to basics and say, what do we start with? Well, we start with general relativity, the universe being homogeneous and isotropic. And then we write down the metric for a homogeneous, isotropic, flat universe. And basically, all the properties of the homogeneous universe is determined by A of t, the evolution of the expansion factor. And that's described by the Friedman equation. And the key parameter in the Friedman equation is the density of the universe. And I can relate that density to the critical density. And the observations seem consistent with this omega, the ratio of the density to the critical density, being close to 1. Now, first thing I think that's useful to ask is, OK, we're dealing with a metric theory. Why do we believe we have a metric theory? What are some of the tests of it? And there's actually some nice tests. And I just want to draw people's attention to some nice work done with the supernova data that people usually don't, as a cosmological test that we usually don't think so much about. And that's looking for time dilation in the supernova. And supernova light curves have some real regularity to them. You look at a supernova light curve in a nearby supernova, you look at the light curve, look at the spectrum of a supernova. A week after the supernova, you look at the spectrum 2 weeks after, 3 weeks after, there's some regular patterns that you can fit for. And of course, because of time dilation, you look at a supernova at redshift of 1, the pattern at 14 days at redshift 1 looks the pattern at 7 days at redshift 0. And you can test that. And there's a nice recent paper, Blondin et al., which goes through that. And I thought it was good to advertise this. This has one citation. I think it's one of these really great tests of standard cosmology. So you can look at, as a function of redshift, how much you have to age the supernova and this is fitting the light curves of different supernovae, spectrum versus time of different supernova. This would be a no evolution model. And this is the standard cosmology. So it looks like time dilation happens the way we expected. And that's good. So now let's move on and use our metric theory to talk about the properties of the universe. Now there are two basic things we measure in terms of measuring distance. Let me just remind you that we have a luminosity distance. The way we measure that observationally is we observe a flux from an object. And then if we know its intrinsic luminosity, we can solve for the luminosity distance. And the second is the angular diameter distance. And there, if I know the characteristic size of an object, and I measure an angle, I can determine the angular diameter distance. These two, in any metric theory, are just related by a factor of 1 plus e squared. One of the things I sometimes hear people talk about is saying, well, if we need to test to see if they're consistent, that's why we want to have both supernova and BAO data. Now, there's good reason to get independent data sets as a way of testing systematics and methods. But I actually think we have some very good constraints on the angular diameter distance and luminosity distance being the same. And that comes from the fact that the microwave background is such a beautiful black body. So you can imagine if somehow you had a tired light theory or some theory in which as the universe expanded and the number of photons as the volume grew as a cubed, that the energy didn't redshift the same way as the volume. So you had a different factor there, which is all that really goes into the ratio of luminosity distance to angular diameter distance. And the fact that the microwave power, the spectrum of the microwave background, and these are results from COBE, so these are quite old, but they're still actually the best results we basically have on the shape of the spectrum. And this is one of these wonderful plots where the errors on these points are inflated by a factor 400. So we really have superb measurements of the Planck spectrum, and let's see that, and we know that the CMB spectrum is quite close to Planckian. So any modification that affects any tired light like our theory is going to have to cope with the constraints from things like the CMB. Broadly speaking, when we talk about the properties of dark energy, we're going to see it through one of two sets of measurements. Either we'll measure distance, and by measuring distance, we can infer the Hubble constant versus redshift. From the Hubble constant versus redshift, we can infer what the density is. And, you know, broadly speaking, the evidence for dark energy from distance primarily comes from the fact that when we look at Hubble constant versus expansion factor, that at late times, the Hubble constant, the universe starts accelerating, the Hubble rate changes in time. So our measurements of the Hubble rate will plot out that plot here. This is directly looking at the homogeneous part of general relativity. And the other part comes from looking at linear perturbation theory and looking at growth rate. And the idea here is I start with my homogeneous universe. And I generalize my things, and I say my density is a function of position and expansion factor, can be split into a uniform piece plus a spatially fluctuating piece. And that spatially fluctuating piece, let's take its Fourier transform, its evolution should depend only on wave number in a homogeneous universe and A. And in fact, the evolution equation for the growth function can be written like this. This just comes from taking general relativity and doing linear perturbation theory. So if GR is right, the distance measurements and the growth rate should be consistent and obey this equation. And you note that you follow this equation regardless of what the properties of dark energy is. You know, anything you do to the components, you're still going to satisfy this equation. So the theme of this talk is going to be that we want to look at ways in which we can measure distance, ways in which we can measure growth. And I think one of the fundamental things we want to be able to test observationally is, are we seeing consistency between these two approaches? And I think it's a question worth asking, because the fact that we are seeing this acceleration means that there's something odd going on in gravity. And I think this is an observational way of testing which side of the equation is coming. So let me now talk about ways in which we measure distance. And what I want to do is give an overview in the next, the rest of my talk, of different observational methods. So one of the very important ways of measuring distance is with supernova. So the good news about supernova is they've worked for us in the past. They've turned out to be a very powerful tool for measuring distance. People talk about supernova as standard candles, but to be more precise, they're standardizable candles, in that there's an observed relationship between the width of the supernova light curve. So you measure the flux from the supernova versus time and get a characteristic decay time. And there's an observed relationship between the decay time and the luminosity. So if I measure that, I know its luminosity, I can standardize it. You know, when I think of supernova, I always think of these commercials where they try to sell you stocks. And they tell you, past performance is no guarantee of future performance. And I feel we're getting into, my view is actually we're getting into that regime of supernova. We know of a whole bunch of astrophysical reasons why supernova properties ought to vary as a function of redshift and time, right? The supernova spectrum, or the supernova flux are affected by dust. We think the properties of dust, we know the properties of dust are different in a galaxy like ours and in galaxies like the Magellanic Clouds, so that the dust properties evolve with redshift in ways we'll have to figure out how to remove. Perhaps more importantly, the properties of the supernova evolve with redshift. One of the disturbing things about type 1a supernova is we actually don't know what the progenitors are for sure. There are two paths, at least, that people talk seriously about. One is the explosive burning of a single white dwarf, where you accrete matter over time until you exceed the Chandrasekhar limit. The second is the merger between two white dwarfs. We know from observations of supernova rate versus time that there seem to be two routes to supernova, in that the supernova rate in the galaxy seems to scale with the sum of a term proportional to luminosity of the galaxy, and or the mass, stellar mass in the galaxy, and a term proportional to star formation. So the supernova rates are higher in young galaxies with lots of young stars than galaxies with old stars. So there seems to be two populations that contribute to supernovae. And so we suspect that the supernova properties depend on the age and hence the mass of the star that goes supernova, probably the chemical composition of the progenitors, what is the abundances there. And in the supernova explosions, they're thought to be off-centered explosions. And those the efficiency of burning probably depends on how that goes off. All those things probably correlate with the width of the supernova light curve, which is why we can remove them to first order and get them to be reasonable standard candles. What's less clear is whether they all correlate exactly with that. There's probably some, there's no reason to believe they do, and one of the worries we'll have is that as we go to high redshift, supernova will start to show significant systematic effects. But I think they will turn out to be the most effective way of measuring distance at low redshift. And this shows one view of the current supernova data. And what's plotted here are two samples, the Supernova Legacy Survey, Adam Riess's gold sample. And this is the distance modulus compared to an empty universe. Basically, you can think of this as how a positive number here shows that the supernova are dimmer than they would be in an empty universe. The curve here shows the best fit parameters for cosmological parameters from the WMAP data. So it shows that these things are very consistent. And these are two independent data sets with different groups, and shows the supernova are, data have continued to improve and are getting pretty, you know, consistent evidence for a cosmological constant. The next way we have measuring of distance is through angular diameter distance. And first, there are two methods that are sort of linked together that I want to talk about for angular diameter distance. First, measurements of the microwave background. When we look at the microwave background, we're basically looking back to the universe at redshift of 1,000, the time at which electrons and protons combine to make hydrogen in the universe became transparent. There's a characteristic size scale for fluctuations then set by the distance a sound wave could move, and that serves as an effective ruler that gives us the distance to redshift of 1,000. So this is the constraint we have from CMB that we know well. How far away is, what is the angular diameter distance to redshift of 1,000? That gives an overall constraint on cosmological parameters. The other things that we measure well from the CMB are the baryon to photon ratio, baryon to radiation ratio, the matter to radiation ratio. This gives us omega matter h squared. We also end up constraining things like the neutrino to photon density. We've just are beginning to get constraints on that from WMAP, but when you look forward towards Planck, you'll see very strong constraints there. These ratios here, together with the distance, already constrains you to have something close, argues pretty strongly for a cosmological constant. And in combined with other measurements, this measurement of basically omega matter h squared and this distance give us very useful cosmological constraints. Just to show you what the data looks like and how that goes, this is the WMAP 5-year data complemented by ACBAR, Boomerang, and CBI on small scales. And the purple line shows the best fit parameter. The points here are plotted with both the statistical errors, which for WMAP are the dominant errors from here on over, and the cosmic variance errors due to the fact that we only see what, you know, our portion of the universe, so that the value of the quadrupole, for example, is quite uncertain. We effectively only measure 4 or so independent multiples, missing one because of our uncertainties in moving the galaxy. So just to go over again how we measure cosmological parameters, things like the baryon density affects the shape of the spectrum. We're looking at sound waves in the early universe here. So how those sound waves propagate depends on the speed of the medium. So this red curve is the standard best fit. And these black lines show the effects of increasing the baryon density by 10, 20, 30, and 40%. And you can see they raise the height of the first peak, lower the height of the second peak. Since the evolution of the fluctuations depend upon when the universe made the transition from radiation domination to matter domination, one of the many coincidences in the universe is that the transition from radiation to matter domination occurs at redshift 2000, which is very close to redshift 1100, when the universe went from ionized to neutral. I sometimes wonder if we were living at that time, whether we'd be somehow writing papers on the coincidence problem, that the binding energy of hydrogen happens to be just right and tuned in just the right way to the, let's say, the dark matter supersymmetric, to the supersymmetric cross-section. So those two are the same within a factor of 2. So when you know, I think when you think about the various events that have happened in the history of the universe, whether it's nuclear synthesis, dark matter creation, recombination, dark matter domination, neutrinos becoming non-relativistic, dark energy dominating. We live in a kind of Mr. Rogers universe. One of the properties of the expanding universe, cooling universe, is every time is special. And you're all living in a special time, and you're all special people. So here's the temperature and temperature polarization spectrum. Here are the individual multiples measured. And here's our, from our WMAP analysis from the five-year data, our best fit values for the density of atoms, the density of matter, the amplitude of fluctuations, how those fluctuations vary with scale, the age of the universe, and also the optical depth of the universe due to reionization from the first generation of stars. And what's quite nice when you look at the CMB is you go to smaller scales, the same model continues to fit the data. So the red line is the based on the WMAP fit, and these points here are measurements now at much higher multiples out in the tail by the ACVAR experiment. And we're going to see rapidly improving data here in the next couple of years. I am pretty confident that this year both the ACT and SPT collaboration will report results. I actually was coming from an ACT telecon with you going over what we're doing. So I know both experiments have much improved results on these smaller scales. Planck is launched. I think we'll know within about another 6 weeks or so. Once Planck cools down, the detectors turn on, we will know, or Planck team members will know, and I'm sure we'll hear from them this much, that the experiment's working. In fact, you know, with WMAP, once we got the first data down, you can see the dipole in the galaxy instantaneously in the time order data. For Planck, where the sensitivities per unit time are 10 times better, you'll actually see in the instantaneous data the CMB fluctuation. So they will know as soon as they get the first data down that's working, right? And I think for Planck, most of the risky things are gone, having gone through launch, separated from Herschel Planck. I think one of the big remaining worries is that all the multi-stage cooling works properly. And once that goes, it works well, and I think we'll know soon. We should be pretty confident we'll be seeing very good Planck results. So in addition to the temperature measurements, we have temperature polarization measurements. And you know, these are very nicely tracing out the form that we expect for adiabatic fluctuations. I think are telling us that we're seeing primarily adiabatic modes. Though I should note that there's data is consistent with a modest admixture of isocurvature modes. And again, that's one of the things we're going to see improve with the Planck data is, you know, and you know, on my kind of, you know, my long list of what surprises might we see from Planck? And one of them is we might see evidence for isocurvature modes and the like. So the CMB gives us for this problem of thinking about the dark energy, you know, I think the key things are a measurement of omega matter h squared and the angular diameter distance to redshift of 1100. And because it also gives us the baryon density, it's going to not calibrate a standard ruler that we can use to look at baryon acoustic oscillations. And the idea here for baryon acoustic oscillations is we can think about what happens if I set up an initial fluctuation at early times and look at basically what the Green's functions are for density fluctuations. So these are some slides that I stole from Dan. Oops, I guess I skipped them. I guess I didn't embed the movie. Okay. So this if you look at what the, you start with a delta function fluctuation in density, ask what happens to the fluctuations in dark matter and in the baryons and photons. The dark matter is cold, so it basically stays where you put it. But the baryons and photons are coupled as a fluid where the photons provide significant pressure. So you start out with an overdensity, max stress pressure. You set up a sound wave. The sound wave propagates. And this sound wave propagates, you know, of order 120 megaparsecs and is going outwards at, you know, a significant fraction of the speed of light. And that number, 57%, comes from measuring the baryon to photon ratio from the CMB. So we've got that number pretty well calibrated. What happens at over time is that the dark matter responds to the potential, the baryons decouple from the photons. So we're left with a universe in which there are fluctuations from the baryons imposed on the dark matter as well, so that there's a characteristic scale put into the large scale structure. What that means is that the correlation function of galaxies are going to have a characteristic scale, the distance a sound wave can move, embedded on that. Question? Excellent.
Bang, right. That sound wave. What went bang? Was it the universe or a supernova or what?
No, it was density. Would something set up density fluctuations do? So we think that the one possibility is probably the standard one. The universe underwent a period of rapid expansion called inflation. That part of the universe inflated more than that part. That part ended up denser, that part ended up less dense. So, so that the.
Push it up.
That's the same. Okay. So if we look at what the density fluctuations look like at some given wave number in redshift, I can relate it to some initial density fluctuations at some very early time times the Green's function for those fluctuations. So it's asking, I set up some initial fluctuation, how does it evolve? This is the Green's function in real space. So I ask, I set up some initial overdensity. The way we're probably setting this up is through inflation, but it doesn't really matter for this problem as long as they're adiabatic fluctuations. And those density fluctuations will produce, this is the response to those density fluctuations. Mostly you get the clustering of dark matter around the density fluctuations. But because the sound wave that's set out, you also get an additional feature in how galaxies cluster. And this scale is just how far a sound wave can move, because that's going to lead to an excess in galaxies on that scale as the sound wave goes out. Once the electrons and protons combine to make hydrogen, the universe becomes transparent to the photons. The photons free stream, so this leaving the baryons behind. Right. So to go back here, the baryons and photons are coupled. The photons, because of their pressure, have dragged the baryons out this distance. Once the universe recombines, they decouple and the photons become uniform, leaving this peak in baryons. Interestingly, it's a sort of an interesting subtle point, but dark matter doesn't quite catch up completely. So there's actually variations in the baryon to dark matter ratio as a function of scale that could actually have a small imprint on galaxy properties. And that's because the rate at which galaxies cool and form depend upon the how many baryons you have to cool. And if you look at the data, which I'll show next, there's actually the observed amplitude of the signal is slightly above the theoretical expectations. And that may be due to the fact that elliptical galaxies can cool more effectively than you naively estimate because there are large scale fluctuations in the baryon to dark matter ratio. That's right, but right.
Well, if you look, what we measure, if you can think of it as what we observe is the power spectrum versus scale. If there wasn't this baryon acoustic term, you would just have power. What it does is imprints wiggles on power spectrum. Those wiggles actually make more sense in real space than in k-space because it's a characteristic scale. So if you look at the correlation function versus scale, and I'll weight the galaxy correlation function by r squared just to remove the smooth, slowly varying part, you get something like that without the BAO physics. When you add it in, you've got a bump. And that bump is from the sound waves. And we know that distance, we can use that. And
this is from the Sloan data. And this purple curve is the correlation function that you'd expect to see if there wasn't this BAO physics. And this red curve is about close to the best fit value from CN. WMAP data, and you can see that there's pretty good evidence for that peak. And by measuring that peak position, you're measuring it on the sky, so you're measuring an angle. It's now one of these geometric things where I know the length of my ruler, it's 150 megaparsecs. I measure the angular scale on which this correlation function peaks. That gives me the distance to that redshift. So this gives a measurement to the distance at redshift 0.35.
Because they kept the baryon density constant, and it goes as the ratio of baryon to matter. Right, so this goes as omega b to omega matter. And you can understand that because the dark matter has to catch up and then pulls the peak down. So if we lived in a universe that had only baryons, there was no cold dark matter, and you got rid of cold dark matter by some, the need for cold dark matter by some alternative gravity theory, you need to also make sure that theory somehow gets this right too, right? Because you've gone, the height of this peak is telling us about the baryon to dark matter ratio. If we had a baryon only universe and kept everything else the same, this peak height would be 6 times higher.
You can only get that correct in the modified gravity if you remove the CDM.
If you do what?
If you remove the CDM.
Right.
You have to modify Einstein gravity.
That's right.
To get that
right. That's right. And you have to modify Einstein. If you remove the CDM, you have to modify Einstein gravity in just the right way to get this right. So this is a constraint on modified gravity theories, particularly ones that try to remove cold dark matter. So that this is it's not a no-go theory that you can't deal with modified gravity, but it means if you write down your favorite version of Tevis or Mond or whatever.
Mond.
Well, if you write down Mond in the naive way, in which you end up running into trouble here. Now, it's a constraint. It doesn't rule it out, but it says that things have to behave this way. It's a constraint that one needs just to be mindful of in thinking about the dark matter. This is actually the fact that you see the acoustic peaks the way we do see them, and we see the BAO peak. I think actually is much stronger evidence for cold dark matter than the bullet cluster, which is whose interpretation I think is actually much more complicated.
No, it's just a comment. I can't resist. Physicists power spectrum, I get a very good fit to get a lot of CDM for my modified transistors.
That's a good test. You know, I think what's interesting about lambda CDM is it now passes a lot of tests. That doesn't mean that it's correct, but it means that any alternative theory ought to do at least as well.
Yeah. Another question about this. This also, if it didn't need otherwise to be killed, this kills the idea that the cold dark matter is something like black holes that used to be baryons that then decoupled late.
That's right. So it's consistent with black holes that formed early, right? So if it's black holes that formed before redshift of 10,000, it would be completely consistent. But it's inconsistent with what seemed like a very plausible idea 10, 15 years ago, which is that the first objects to form
form black holes,
form black holes. Yeah. And then decoupled. So now I want to turn from measuring distance to measuring growth. And the idea here is to get a handle on this growth rate versus redshift and number and look at different ways we can measure it and talk about the strengths and weaknesses of these different approaches. So let me talk about measuring how we do this. Well, first thing we need to do, we want to measure a growth. We want to know where we started from. And the way we can do that is not measuring it at redshift 0, but measuring it at redshift 1100. So the microwave background tells us what's the amplitude of fluctuations at redshift 1100. And we can then measure how much have they grown since then and look at the growth rate versus redshift. In many ways, it's easiest to do this in the linear regime by just looking at the clustering of matter. And probably what looks like in some ways the at least the cleanest approach theoretically is weak lensing of a microwave background, where you look at matter fluctuations in matter along the line of sight between us and distant galaxies, deflect the paths of photons, and distort the shapes of galaxies. So if you've got an overdense region that the average shape of galaxies, instead of being on average circular, will get distorted and sheared. And by measuring the alignments between galaxies, we can measure the shear field and learn about the integrated matter distribution along one site. By using galaxies at different redshifts, we can measure how the matter fluctuations evolve with time. One of the big projects that the astronomy community is considering doing for the coming decade is the LSST, which will carry out a very large survey of the whole of the visible sky from Chile and measure distortions in billions of galaxies. Now, when you look at these kinds of surveys, there's a number of systematics you have to worry about. Some are systematics that occur in your instrument, distortions in the shape of your telescope, for example. Distortions in the mirror can produce coma. Distortions in the atmosphere can produce random noise. But a more concerning effect is that galaxies themselves tend to line up with each other just because of tidal effects of galaxies on their neighbors. And this means if you're looking at pairs of galaxies at the same redshift, there'll be a tendency for them to line up, not because of lensing, but just because of tidal interactions. And because we're trying to look for subtle effects, this is a very important systematic, and the only way to really get around this is to know the redshift distribution of your galaxies so that you can be careful when you correlate galaxies. So this one might be at redshift 0.7 and this at 0.5. And that requires getting redshifts for very large numbers of galaxies. Getting redshifts are expensive. So what astronomers do is they do cheap redshifts called photometric redshifts, where instead of taking the spectrum, you measure the color with different filters. That has devolved into a whole industry that's where we're learning about the right way to do that. Another way to measure linear amplitude is to measure, to look at galaxy redshift surveys. And that gives you the galaxy power spectrum. You then need to relate that to the matter power spectrum. The challenge is then to figure out how do we relate clumpiness in galaxies to clumpiness in matter. And an approach that I think is really intriguing to think about is using the lensing of the microwave background so that matter fluctuations not only shear galaxy images, but distort the microwave background. One of the things that's now been seen with the WMAP data by two external groups, Smith et al. And Harada et al., is they've detected a correlation between lensing of the WMAP data and the large-scale distribution of galaxies. This measurement gives an amplitude of bias in the galaxies. That's a first detection. They've seen it at about 3 sigma levels, so they've got a pretty uncertain measurement. But this is something that will get much better with Planck and much better with upcoming experiments like ACT and SPT and even better with future CMB polarization experiments so that you can look, our estimates are that you can get signal to noise of better than 100 by cross-correlating lensing in Planck or lensing a polarization experiment with big galaxy surveys. That, in turn, that gives us a measurement of the relationship between the galaxy fluctuations and matter fluctuations. That lets us normalize the galaxy fluctuations and get a better measure of the linear amplitude. Just moving along to some of the other methods, there are a lot of papers that rely on counting peaks. So the idea here is you measure the number of objects of a given mass as a function of redshift. For a Gaussian field, that should be the number of fluctuations above a critical density. This is the famous Press-Schechter form. And since the amplitude of fluctuations depends upon the growth rate of structure, if we can count the number of objects, we can measure the growth of structure. The notion here is you start out with this Gaussian random field. With time, its amplitude grows. And you can estimate the number of, relate the number of peaks you see of a given mass to the amplitude of fluctuations. And there are a bunch of techniques that rely on doing this, counting the number of lensing clusters. There's a lot of interest right now in measuring the SV signal. People have been using this with X-ray properties. The challenge in using this technique is relating what you observe, the signal from hot gas, the amplitude of the X-ray signal, to the mass of the galaxy. And while people have calibrated these relationships at low redshift, there's no reason to believe that there's not a time evolution in the mass observable relation. And I predict that in the next 5 years, there'll be papers claiming evidence for time variable W based on analysis of cluster catalogs. And I suspect it will be telling us more about the mass observable.
That's a promise.
If we write them, it'll take us a long, long time to believe we calibrated this. And I think there are ways you can think about calibrating this. So, for example, with the SC effect, looking at strong lensing of the cluster that you detect and doing that at many different redshifts. But it's it'll be risky. And on the other hand, I think one should be a little, though I'll show some of the data, I think in a couple plots, nervous about papers that say, look, we've got this right, therefore we've constrained dark energy. Because if they got it wrong, it didn't fit, people might not be willing to accept the results.
I think one has to worry about the systematics here.
Problem with this very equation.
Okay.
And just on the left-hand side, you have nonlinear objects that are clusters, and on the right-hand side, you have the linear growth, which are completely linear.
Right.
And so they are very different, right? So you don't think this, I mean, this might be holding within certain assumptions, but you don't think, you believe in general there would be a relationship between linear and nonlinear growth, right?
I would put a simultaneous sim equal to.
Sorry,
yes, I put a semi-equal to something.
Okay,
right?
I see.
Right, because we're treating off in this particular derivation, which is nice to write down a simple equation. We're assuming that the fluctuations are spherical. But we don't,
even with that assumption.
So, and, you know, and we're ignoring external shear, external fields, which also do it. So there's lots of assumptions that go into this. This equation, I think, is a useful to get an understanding of how things go. In practice, if we actually, I think we understand the nonlinear evolution of dark matter well enough that for a given model, we can compute NMC pretty accurately. There are some refinements one needs to do to dark matter clothes to get the precision you need to map the quantum. But I think we know how to do that.
But you see my problem. You want to use this to probe the linear evolution of dark matter.
Right.
So that assumes that you don't know the linear evolution of dark matter because you want to use this
to
find it.
I think what you could do, which would be pretty robust for the dark matter, is you tell me your cosmology. You tell me your PFZ behavior. Mm-hmm. I'll run a numerical simulation and count objects. And in the context of lambda, what people are doing in practice is they're taking lambda CDN, computing those numbers. I think measuring this from a lambda CDN simulation, how many objects you have with a given mass, then comparing that to observations. I don't think the problem lies in the numerical simulation of dark matter evolution, but in relating dark matter mass to observable.
Well, that's one problem.
Yeah. Another approach that's interesting to think about is to use redshift space distortions so that when we observe galaxies, we don't observe galaxies' positions in three-dimensional physical space, but we observe them in what we call redshift space. We measure the galaxy's redshift. If we're living in a homogeneous universe, then that redshift would be directly related to distance. But of course, the galaxies are moving because of inhomogeneities. And there's an interesting effect that Nick Kaiser talked about 20 years ago, which is if you have a density fluctuation, this is along the line of sight, looking towards me, this is a variance in density, material flows towards denser regions. That means this galaxy's redshift is actually a little closer than you would have thought in a homogeneous universe. This enhances the amplitude of fluctuations along the line of sight. This means that the power spectrum we measure when we take our galaxy maps, measure the power spectrum in redshift space, is enhanced along the line of sight, where this mu is the angle towards the line of sight. This enhancement just depends upon the growth rate of structure. So by measuring this redshift distortion at different redshifts for a galaxy sample, I can measure how structure grows. I need to solve for the relationship between galaxy and matter fluctuations, but one can think about doing that either with the CMB measurements or with just within the galaxy survey, some other information you have. So this is yet another way at getting at structure growth. This is where we are at the moment with these different methods, and where we're looking at what's the best fit model in terms of the fraction of omega in dark energy and W, or the equation of state of the dark energy, where W is defined so that it's dp d rho for the component, or equivalently, that the density in dark matter
is going as expansion factor times minus 3 times 1 plus W. So W is equal to 0 for dark matter, 1/3 for radiation, and minus 1 for a cosmological constant. So that our fiducial lambda CDM model has W naught of minus 1. Let's just focus on this plot here. This just shows these different techniques. This BAO shows the set of values consistent with the angular diameter distance to redshift 0.35. This shows the range of parameters consistent with the supernova data. And this is basically the distance to about redshift 0.5. This shows the range of values in blue consistent with the WMAP data, basically the angular diameter distance to redshift of 1100. This dark blue region shows the values consistent just with measurements of distance. So here we're measuring distance only. In red, we're measuring growth of structure only. This comes from measurements of the number of X-ray clusters combined with the WMAP data. So at the moment, we're getting the same answer by these two paths, from the homogeneous theory and from the growth of structure. So the current data seems consistent with general relativity because we're measuring things in both ways. And it seems consistent with what I would argue is sort of the null hypothesis at this moment, which is W equals minus 1, a cosmological constant.
And going in?
It has the volume factor as well. So it's a bit of a mixture of it. They both have to be right.
One way of looking at the self-consistency is we can actually write down a dimensionless parameter that should be zero, which is using the fact that the density fluctuations, rho is omega matter to the gamma, where gamma is about 0.55, 0.56. This is sort of a generic solution over a pretty wide range of models for how the growth factor behaves. We can relate the matter density to the omega matter to omega matter h dot squared, what we measure from CMB. So CMB tells us this. Our distance indicators tell us the Hubble constant, because we're measuring distance. And the growth of structure measures this as a function of wave number. So we can actually combine all our observables into this one term here. If general relativity is the correct description of what's going on, this should be zero, as a independent of wave number and scale. If we're seeing some deviation from general relativity, it should it may well show up in this relationship here. And in fact, if you look at many of the alternative models that have been proposed, they have effects that show up not only as a function of redshift, but particularly as a function of scale. And this is something where I think we will see significant improvements in our ability to measure this pretty soon. So this plot here shows how well we should be able to measure the power spectrum as a function of time. The big black arrow bars are where we are today with Sloan, which is pretty good. Right now, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is carrying out a new survey called Sloan 3 that's now underway that will measure luminous red galaxies, very bright galaxies, over a volume that's more than 10 times larger than the current Sloan survey. With that much larger volume, it will measure the baryon acoustic peaks over a larger scale. And it'll also get a better measurement of the power spectrum. Right now, NASA and ESA are engaged with DOE in a very complicated dance about what they will do for the next big mission. But one of the versions of it is a mission on the US side called the depth, on the European side called space. That would be 100 million galaxy survey, actually, I think current form, 200 million galaxies. That would lead to an extremely accurate measurement of the galaxy power spectrum and of redshift space distortions. With those measurements, we'd be able to look for these deviations in growth of structure. And what I view as the goal in this field is to get as accurate measurements of the Hubble constant over a wide range of redshifts as possible, and an accurate measurement of the growth of structure over a wide range of redshifts as possible, using these different techniques. And there are lots of different either ongoing or proposed experiments that might help address this. I think the combination of these different approaches, if we're lucky, will yield yet more surprises. I think we were all surprised to see the observations slowly come in, suggesting dark energy, and then with the evidence from the supernova, the case getting much stronger. It's quite reasonable to expect that the universe might surprise us again. If we're lucky, we will get a hint that will tell us what's the right approach to understanding the nature of the acceleration. Let me stop there. Thanks.
Two comments. A large scale experiment is underway to detect dark matter. Underground and the LHC and so on. And eventually, we will get to the point where we can see the dark matter besides inferring it from that.
Right.
So, at what stage do we reach that? The second question is, there's another way of explaining supernova data in the large voids and homogeneous magnetotonal body lines, etc. What is your opinion about these two questions?
Okay, so the first question is, dark matter detection for the LHC and underground experiments. And one of the things where things are moving very quickly with the LHC turning on, big dark matter experiments, is we're now going to be able to probe a very interesting region of parameter space for one dark matter tenor. An interesting one, but not the only one, supersymmetric dark matter. Even if, this is something where if we see supersymmetric dark matter, it'd be wonderful. But even if we don't see it, unfortunately, you can't even rule out the supersymmetric dark matter models. There's enough uncertainty in the parameter space, and that's a big enough family of models, that evidence of absence will not be, absence of evidence will not be evidence of absence. It won't rule it out. It's disappointing. You'd like to be able to rule out the dark matter particle hypothesis experimentally, and I don't think you can. You can't explore all parameter space. What you can do is test the cold dark matter hypothesis. Actually is quite predictive. It makes predictions on the linear regime for what you should see for lensing and nonlinear regime. So what we can and have been doing, I think the limits will continue to improve, is test the notion of cold dark matter astronomically. And I think that's where we have a chance of perhaps ruling it out. For example, if the cluster had a characteristic scale, if there was a minimum mass for galaxies, we might see evidence for warm dark matter. But I think the experiments can only show evidence for, they can't rule out dark matter. On these void models, I think they're very hard to make consistent with the microwave background. So the idea here is to say that we're in a large local underdensity, right? And after all, what we're measuring with these distance indicators are the distance between here and redshift 0.5. So we're on a large underdense bubble, and use that to explain the supernova data. The problem with that is if we were not in the center of this large bubble, there'd be an enormous signal on the microwave background. And if these large bubbles were, in order
The microwave background is very sensitive to large scale and homogeneities. So if we lived in a universe that had many large empty bubbles, we would see an enormous imprint on the microwave background, both from the bubbles at the surface of last scatter and from photons coming in and out of these very large underdensities. In order to match something like the voids, these bubbles are so large and so empty, this could not just have been a big signal in WMAP, it would have been a big signal in COBE, it would have probably been seen by the pre-COBE experiments. It's an enormous area. So to make those models work, we have to be living in the only bubble and in the middle of it. And even in that case, I'm not sure it's consistent with observations. So I actually, for that reason, tend to ignore those papers. Other questions? Yeah.
So if you look at the standard decomposition into matter with an equation of state, you know, and then something else with an equation of state you're trying to constrain, is there any constraint beyond that you do have those two contributions? I mean, if you had, you know, say two dark components with different equations of state, do you have any extra leverage on that, or do you just get some sort of average constraint on the equation of state?
Well, if you had, say,
so suppose, for instance, you had some kind of exotic dark matter that was decaying or doing something weird at late times, and therefore its equation of state was changing gradually.
Right.
Is there?
Yeah. So we would actually have significant constraints on that. So let's say we have two types of dark matter. One, both didn't couple to baryons, photons. They have pretty good constraints on any coupling to baryons and photons. They don't couple to baryons and photons. They're both cold. But one is stable and one's unstable. The unstable one, if it contributes significantly to the total density of the universe, as it decays, would show up not so much in the expansion rate, because the dark energy dominates, but would show up in its late decays and how density fluctuations begin. Because density fluctuations would decay as the dark matter decays. Galaxies, dark matter halos would expand. And we would see significant changes in the properties of the numbers of halos of a given mass and size. We would also see additional microwave background fluctuations as photons came in and out of the decaying potentials. That's more important at earlier time. Well, I think actually we'd notice it more in the number and size of galaxy halos. We have reasonable constraints on that from the weak lensing observations. I think the nicest set comes from the Sloan survey, where Rachel Mandelbaum and others have taken the galaxies in the Sloan survey in the foreground, stacked them up, looked at the shape of background galaxies as a function of separation, looking for this lensing effect, using this to measure the mass distribution in typical galaxy halos. And what they see is consistent with the CDM expectations, so would constrain the existence of a significant fraction of the dark matter being in some form that is decayed at late times. That doesn't rule out things that decay with anything where the dark matter lifetime is comparable to the Hubble time is probably ruled out. You know, there are models where people want to explain things like the positron excess in Pamela. And those have lifetimes long compared to the Hubble time. So those are not constrained by galaxy properties. Yep.
So in the formula for epsilon, the new parameter, the growth factor is the clustering potential or the lensing potential, and whether it is important.
It actually, in some ways, I've written it down as if it's the same thing. Right, but you can hear, you can look at, and several different groups have talked about this with you guys, and, I can look at the evolution of the various Bardeen potentials and look at their growth factor separately, and look at the ratio between them. I can look at the, as I start to modify gravity, I can think about the modifications actually affecting the velocity fields, the density fields, and the lensing separately. right? I mean, one can go through my different observables, and they're actually measuring slightly different things. Right here, if I'm measuring this lensing, I'm getting a different, you know, I'm getting the potential fluctuations. While here, I'm looking more at the density field. And here, I'm looking at the velocity field. And depending where you do your modification, it might show up in different places. So I think what's interesting to, you know, regard, you know, for lambda CDM, standard gravity, this is all the same growth factor. So you expect this to be zero no matter what. So I think the way I think about this is we want to test this in many different ways as possible. And anywhere we find deviation, that'll be an important thing.
Okay, I think let's thank David again. He'll be around the rest of the time.